And Jacko, we have two bills this morning. The first is the continuation of Senate Bill 54 from yesterday, Offenses of Juvenile Offenders, which I would like to do first. We do have Senator Halford, and then we'll go to Senate Bill 53, Annulling Abortion Funding Regulations. We have before us Senate Bill 54. We adopted a CS yesterday. You have in your packet new fiscal notes for the Alaska court system, for the Public Defenders Agency, for the Office of Public Advocacy. They are, I think, are all paperclipped together, and you have a top sheet which shows the final numbers on the new fiscal note. You'll note that to the CS, after working with the prime sponsor and agencies, the advocacy fiscal note is down to $22,500. The court's fiscal notes are down to $24,500. These will be Senate Finance fiscal notes. Senator Frank, do you have anything you'd like to offer to the CS as we adopted it yesterday?
Go back and revisit the amendment prepared by Senator Rieger yesterday and offer that again. I think I've changed my mind about the appropriateness of that.
Okay, let him, you want to just re-offer the amendment?
I would re-offer the amendment.
And ask unanimous consent? Okay, so the amendment by Senator Rieger. Yesterday that amendment was the amendment to amendment number one. Today it is the amendment. It deletes, I believe, section 9. And unanimous consent has been requested. Is anyone opposed to that? Okay. So we now have a CS before us, a finance CS with new fiscal notes without Section 9. Senator Kelly.
Madam Chair, I would move the Senate CS for Senate Bill 54 out of committee with individual recommendations.
Okay, there's a motion to move Senate Bill CS for Senate Bill 54 finance from committee with individual recommendations. Is anyone opposed? Okay, the bill has been moved. Senator Halford, we very much appreciate the help of your staff working with us.
The motion was to move the bill. And has the amendment been adopted?
Yes.
All right. Deleting section 9.
I was talking to the president.
Adopted the strip.
Okay. Yeah, so the bill is moved. Pardon me?
I deleted section 9. I know what you said.
Okay, we will bring before us Senate Bill 53, which is by the Senate Health, Education, and Social Services Committee. It is an act relating to annulling abortion funding regulations. I think we're all pretty familiar with the issue. We do have a finance CS, which was distributed yesterday. Senator Rieger, would you like to speak to the CS? Each of you has been provided a sheet showing the changes.
Madam Chair.
Why don't you do a motion for the adoption so we'll have it before us as a work draft?
Madam Chair, I'll move the finance CS to be before us.
Okay, we have a motion to adopt the finance CS for Senate Bill 53. Is anyone opposed to that?
Object.
Okay, we do have objection. So, Kelly, do you want to speak to your objection? Okay. Let's do a roll call vote, please. This is on adopting the CS.
Senator
Rieger? Yes.
Five to two vote. We do have before us the CS for Senate Bill 53. Senator Rieger, would you like to speak to that CS, please?
Thank you, Madam. The main difference between the CS and the original Senate Bill 53 was to insert language which puts into statute the status prior to the adoption of the regulations. And what that does is preclude the readoption of the same regulations again. And basically, that's all it does. It's in both cases, the bill repeals the regulations. This one essentially puts the repeal of the regulation into statute. It doesn't read that way, but that's the effect of it.
Okay. Are there questions? Senator Meager, would you also like to speak to the fiscal notes? I know that you worked with the agencies on developing them, and quite a few people have been surprised to find that we ended up with negative fiscal notes, an overall negative.
Madam Chairman, when the regulations were adopted or promulgated last year, there were positive fiscal notes associated with the promulgation of those regulations. The repeal of the regulations would, in effect, undo the positive fiscal notes and would restore again the status of funding to, you know, this cost of the state budget to what it was prior to the original promulgation of the regulations. They don't quite match, and I never did have a chance to reconcile why the rollback in the negative fiscal notes was as much as the original cost put forward in the positive fiscal notes, but there is, in essence, a net negative fiscal note.
Okay. Any questions by the committee? Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess a question, looking at the section analysis. And it discusses Section 2. It says that changes to the Medicaid statute and adds a new section that says the department shall pay for abortions to the extent permitted under federal law, and if not permitted under federal law, the state would pay for it out of general funds, basically. That's what it says, right?
Right.
So it does change. It does a little more than just avoiding the regulations. It is codifying in statute Section 2 and Section 3 here. That,
Madam Chairman.
Senator Meager.
Abortions were paid for under Medicaid until they were precluded by federal regulation. The state, for several years, has had the practice of, in essence, first, you know, technically what happens, they first look to the Medicaid reimbursement, and since that's not available, it is bumped down to the general relief medical program. And the difference between the two, in large part, is whether it's 100% general funded or if it's 50% state funded, 50% federal. That the statutes were never changed to reflect the fact that the federal Medicaid regulations had changed. This is to reflect what the practice was, again, prior to the adoption of the regulations.
Go ahead, Senator Sharp.
Through the chair, does this expand the eligibility beyond that offered under the federal Medicare as far as the economic threshold?
Madam Chair,
Senator Reagan.
I don't think so. It never came up, and I don't see how it could. The eligibility for Medicaid and eligibility for general relief medical are both described elsewhere in the statutes of anything that is touched in this bill.
In your opinion, they're fairly
it's
similar.
Same. In my opinion, it's same.
Other questions? Okay, I do have six people signed up to testify. First, we'll take Mr. William Burke. Identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is William Burke.
Okay, please go ahead.
I urge the Senate Finance Committee to pass Senate Bill 53 for several reasons. First, financially, it'd be a lot cheaper for the state to fund abortion than it would to keep the children on the welfare rolls, the DFYS rolls, and public assistance rolls until they're 18 years of age. And I say this because I have worked as a social worker in the state, and I've seen the results of unwanted children. By the time they're 2 years old, 9 out of 10 of them are on the AFDC rolls, where the state has to pay foster parents, the state has to pay welfare rolls, the state has to pay Medicare rolls. You know, so it'd be a lot cheaper, number one. Number two, I feel that the state, or this country, was founded on separation of church and state. And the right-wing conservative Christian fundamentalists are the ones that are pushing through this pro-life thing. I feel a woman has her choice to do what she wants with her child, if she wants to have it aborted or if she doesn't. I also feel that there's going to be abortions no matter whether they're funded or whether they're not. The rich have always had an opportunity to get abortions. The rich have always been able to pay for their abortions no matter whether they have to go out of the country before abortion is legal or not. The poor women are the ones who have suffered. The poor women are the ones who have had their uteruses punctured or perforated, had massive infections, and became sterile and could not have any more children. You know, with an abortion that is legal, there is no problem with it. The women do not become sterile, and they have a chance to get another, have another child when they are ready. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Burke? Thank you, Mr. Burke. Marcia McKenzie with the American Association of University Women. Good morning, Marcia.
Good morning. Senator Pierce, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm here today representing AAUW Alaska, which is the statewide organization for the American Association of University Women. We have branches in Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kodiak, Sitka, Ketchikan, and Juneau. And AAUW has always been very supportive of a woman's right to self-determination and her reproductive rights. And we urge your prompt passage of the committee substitute. We're very pleased with the amendment, the committee substitute that was just adopted by the committee. Abortion services in Alaska are costly to begin with, and when you add on the required travel, it can become prohibitive. It's a sad fact that Alaska's rate of teen pregnancy remains among the highest in the nation, and for an unwanted child, for a young person who has an unwanted child, you're looking at perhaps a lifetime of poverty, the bitterness, the removal of opportunity to perhaps change their life. About 5% of Alaska's population, 20,000 children, are currently being raised by single parents supported by public funding. And the cost there is certainly far outstrips the cost of terminating unwanted pregnancy. And the other thing that one needs to consider without looking at a dollar amount is the psychological burden on both the mother and an unwanted child. The legislation that you're considering will remove the unwarranted intrusion of government into the most private aspects of Alaskan women who can't afford medical care on their own. The regulations stipulate that abortion would be covered by general relief medical in the case of rape or incest or when a mother's life is endangered. For a woman who has become pregnant as a result of rape or incest, this is a horrible thing to have to live with to begin with. And she may not wish to reveal how she came to be pregnant, because that situation in and of itself is difficult, and then having to deal with a pregnancy as a result. So for this to have to be documented, as would be the case if the regulations are strictly enforced and implemented, would be very, very difficult. And then, as Mr. Burke so eloquently pointed out, you've got the issue of separation of church and state. There are some people who believe that a fertilized ova is not yet a person. It may become a person. There's no doubt about that. But for early termination of pregnancy, that is certainly an individual judgment that has to be left to the woman under the separation of church and state. And the problem with the regulations is that they would impose this decision and this moral code only on those who don't have the financial resources to be able to deal with it on their own. Again, if I were in that situation, I have the financial means, I would be able to seek the medical care that I need. There are other women who couldn't. And is it fair that these women are deprived of the control of their own bodies simply because of their financial situation? So again, I thank you. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to answer them.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. McKenzie? Thank you very much. I'm not sure I'm going to get this name right, but Jen, how do you pronounce your last name?
Tucci.
Tucci, okay.
Senator Pierce and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Tucci. I live in Juneau. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify. I urge the passage of this bill. And aside from being a supporter of a woman's right to choose what she wants to do with her own body, I also see this bill as just being an issue of right to privacy and as well as a discrimination issue against women, and specifically for women. And I believe anyone should have the right to make this decision whether or not to get abortion, and it shouldn't be based on whether or not they have money to pay for the procedure or not.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you. Judith Kavanaugh?
Hello, my name is Judith Kavanaugh, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Juneau Coalition for Pro-Choice. We're a group that organized in Juneau a year ago, and since then our coalition and its political action committees have drawn financial and volunteer support from more than 400 people in Juneau. And we've also, through the use of a mail-out survey and phone bank, have compiled a database of 3,800 registered pro-choice women voters in Juneau. I'm here to voice our organization's support for Senate Bill 53. We believe the bill will protect the constitutional right to privacy for all women in Alaska by preserving a woman's right to choose regardless of her income level. Our organization respectfully opposed the regulations when they were first introduced. We were successful in getting more than 700 people in Juneau to voice their opposition to the regulations during the comment period, either by mail or personal testimony at the public hearing. Our opposition to the regulations is focused on the following. Alaska's constitution includes a very broad right to privacy clause that we believe protects a woman's right to choose regardless of whether she is rich or poor. The strictest abortion laws in the world don't stop abortions. What we are really speaking about here is whether Alaska women, particularly low-income women and teenagers, will have access to safe abortion services, or whether through desperation they'll seek help in back alleys or by self-inducing abortions. These regulations will place an undue burden, in the words of the Supreme Court, on poor women in rural Alaska and in southeast Alaska, where abortion services are not available at this time. Trips to Anchorage and Seattle, along with the cost of an abortion, are prohibitive for these women because abortion services are not available close to home. These regulations will force these women to seek out, unsafe abortions or to bear children that they do not want and that they cannot support. Potential social costs of these regulations are enormous. Unwanted children in Alaska often become wards of the state at a great financial and social cost to us all. Thank you, and please support this bill.
Thank you very much, Judith. Are there questions? Thank you. Karen Robinson.
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the Finance Committee, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here representing the League of Women Voters, which has a membership of approximately 400 men and women in the state. We just want to give our strong support for this bill. We also support the committee substitute and urge the passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? The last person I have signed up to testify is Sherry Gall with the Alaska Women's Lobby. If anyone else wishes to testify, I'd appreciate it if you'd go over and use the sign-up sheets. Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning. For the record, Madam Chair, my name is Sherry Gall. I'm representing the Alaska Women's Lobby, and I'm very much in support of Senate Bill 53. I appreciate the fact that the Senate has been moving this bill forward, and we also support the committee substitute, which I think just strengthens the bill. If the bill is to pass the legislature and if it were to withstand a governor's veto, I think there would be an additional savings to the state in not having to defend against what we see as unconstitutional regulations in the court case. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. Let's take a brief recess while we ask Senator Kelly if he wants to be on the record as we move the bill. Because I'm not sure where Senator Kelly went. What's the will of the committee on the CS for Senate Bill 53? Senator Fatula? Okay, there is a motion on the table to move CS for Senate Bill 53 with individual recommendations. There is an objection. Senator Sharp, would you like to speak to your objection?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would just like to say that some of the testimony we've had today pointed out that there are now 20,000, if the information is accurate, 20,000 dependent children from single parents. And I would like to point out that this occurred when the abortion was available option. So I'm not sure that this will make a meaningful effect in that concern. I also somewhat resent the implication of bringing religion into it. I don't see anything in the bill that has anything to do with religion during the testimony. Other than that, that's my objection.
Thank you, Senator Sharp. Anyone else want to speak to the
motion?
Senator Kelly and Senator Rieger.
I really object to the committee substitute. I think this goes far beyond anything that's been discussed prior around here. A good word for it would be greedy. I think it definitely makes certain that there's enough votes out there to sustain a government veto.
Senator Rieger.
Madam Chair, I just want to say I agree with some of the remarks of Senator Sharp that the primary focus of the regulations or the repeal of the regulations has to do with the right to choose of a woman and not the fiscal effect or the effect on the number of dependent children or the effect on how this affects people's feelings on religion. And my support for the bill has to do with the desirability of having a woman's right to choose protected.
Thank you, Senator Rieger. Anyone else? Senator Sharp.
Just make a comment that in Hess Committee, of which I'm a member, I did support the original version. I would continue to support it, but I have fears that this, I go along with what Senator Kelly has said, I fear that we're asking for a possible negative reaction from the administration, which may negate our total efforts.
Any other discussion? Okay, we do have Senator Kelly and Katula's motion on the table to move the bill. Is there continued objection?
Sure.
Okay, we will have a roll call vote. Kathy, please.
Senator
Yes.
No.
Senator Fatula?
Yes.
Senator Reeder?
Yes.
Senator Sharp? No. Senator Payne?
Yes.
Senator Payne? Yes. Okay, CS for Senate Bill 53, Finance, has passed from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes. We have the sign-up sheet. Monday morning at 9, we have Senate Bill 46 to authorize moose farming. Senate Bill 19, the conspiracy bill, and Senate Bill 49, Senator Kelly's year-end campaign finance reports. I understand that Senators Rieger and Jacko are coming in on the morning flight, so if the other members could be on time so we could have a hearing on those bills, I would appreciate it. And with that, we are adjourned. It's a quarter till 10. 3rd, 1993, about 10 minutes after 10 in the morning. We have a full schedule today, gentlemen. At the table are Senators Pierce, Frank, Sharp, Rieger, Kelly, and Jacko. We're going to be bringing first back before the committee Senate Bill 19, that's Senator Halford's crime of conspiracy. Then we'll bring back Senate Bill 46, moose farming. It would be the chair's intention to move both those bills this morning. And we'll have a first hearing in the Finance Committee of Senator Sharp's Senate Bill 106 and Senate Bill 126. In your packets on Senate Bill 19, there's a new letter of intent from Senator Halford that he would like us to adopt as a Finance Committee letter of intent along with the new fiscal notes. Hannah, could you please come forward and speak first about the letter of intent?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I recommend that John Shepard, I work for Senator Halford. Madam Chair, in the letter of intent that Senator Halford is asking the Senate Finance Committee to adopt, basically is intended to address the concerns raised by Senator Kelly and also Senator Petula the last time this committee was hearing Senate Bill 19. Mr. Grelin from the Department of Law had gone back and looked at the existing entrapment statutes that exist, and that's identified here in the letter of intent, 1181-450. And with letter intent basically says is that nothing that's in this bill, Senate Bill 19, should be construed to undermine the entrapment law that already exists. And Mr. Mill is here.
Thank you. Are there any questions about the letter of intent? Okay, you also have in your packets a new packet of fiscal notes. We have reduced the fiscal notes for corrections, courts, public advocacy, and public defender to match the numbers that the Department of Law gave us in terms of the additional numbers of cases that they thought would be brought. You note in the Department of Law's fiscal note, they said that the crime of conspiracy would be added as another count in a case that would have been prosecuted anyway. And they say that the major effect of the conspiracy law is to permit the introduction of additional evidence in a trial. So we do have those. What is the will of the committee on the letter of intent?
Well, Madam Chair, I would move that the letter of intent follow the bill through the Senate Rules Committee.
Okay, would that be a motion to adopt it as a Senate Finance letter?
Yes, that is.
Okay, we have a motion to adopt the letter of intent as a Senate Finance letter of intent. Is there any opposition? Okay, we have the letter of intent. What's the will of the committee on the bill? Senator Rieger?
Madam Chairman, it's okay. I have a couple of questions on the bill.
I
have a couple of questions on the bill. Is it too
on the bill itself? You're welcome to ask. Are they for staff or for Mr. Guarnelli or for whom?
I'll let anybody who can answer them. Just a couple
we'll
of
try.
Questions on how the bill works. I just didn't want to move the bill. Just, yeah, until that means
go ahead.
I was wondering if you could explain on page 2, lines 2 through 13. I'm thinking about juveniles and people who are mentally incompetent. Who gets swept in under letter C there on those lines?
Okay, Mr. Guarnelli, would you please join us?
Maybe we ought to just put it in his name again.
The question is on page 2, approximately line 12 and 13, what does that mean that essentially under Alaska law, in order to be convicted of a crime, you have to commit a certain act, and in doing that, you have to be acting with a certain mental state, and that can be either acting intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly. There are certain factors that would preclude a jury from finding that you acted with a mental state. For example, if you are intoxicated, a jury would be justified in finding that you did not act intentionally. What this says is that if you are conspiring with someone who is intoxicated, and the jury finds that intoxicated person really didn't have the legally required intent to commit that crime, that you can still be convicted for conspiring with that intoxicated person. Just because that other person didn't quite have the right mental framework to be convicted of the crime, that doesn't excuse you for conspiring with that person. That's what that means. It's a pretty technical argument, but it's an argument that some defendants would raise that, well, I conspired with him, but he was intoxicated and he didn't really mean it, so therefore we shouldn't prosecute me for conspiracy. That's what that means.
Senator Rieger.
Take the two and reverse them. Let's say that could there be a situation where if you committed the act, you would be excused because of your mental state, but you wouldn't be excused for conspiring?
You may be excused if there's something peculiar to your mental state, your intoxication or something involving your mental state, but you are not excused for something involving your conspirator's mental state. That's what this says. I mean, if you are intoxicated and therefore the jury believes that you really didn't intend to do this, that excuses you, but your conspirators is something else again. I mean, in other words, the mental states that apply to these offenses are individually based. You can't rely on someone else's deficiencies, mental deficiencies, to escape.
I think you've explained C2. Now, let's go to C1. Take a person who is 12 years old, well, I don't know, maybe AIDS doesn't really figure into this. How do the examples that you're giving apply to lines 3 through 5?
There are a number of offenses under Alaska law that are based on age. For example, there are some offenses in the narcotics offenses where if in order to be convicted of selling drugs to a minor, you have to be a certain number of years older than that minor. And the same applies to some sex offenses. What this says is that the mere fact that you are conspiring with a juvenile or with someone who, by the specific legal definition, is incapable of committing that crime, that again does not excuse you. It may excuse that person, but it doesn't excuse you for hiring a juvenile to go out and do something. I mean, that's
take that. Okay, put that in reverse. If the juvenile conspired with the older person, does the juvenile lose his or her defense?
No. Again, that's a defense that is personal to the juvenile. The juvenile is of an age that they cannot legally commit that crime. They are not going to be guilty of conspiring to commit that crime. The other person may be, but not the juvenile.
How can that... Can you show me where it says that? It says in C, it says it is not a defense that the defendant belongs to a class of persons who are legally incapable of committing the crime.
Well, I may have to rethink that. But my understanding was that I may have misspoken. I'll have to think about that. My belief was that these were provisions that occurred in other areas of Alaska law, and that we followed along with them. I may have spoken about that, the way that particularly applied to that offense.
Senator Rieger, would you like us to hold this bill over for possible amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. When I first read this bill, the thing that jumped out at me was that it could inadvertently sweep in juveniles who conspire with adults. Things they have no idea what they're doing. And this was the area where I wanted to ask the question. I would appreciate that.
Okay, we will hold Senate Bill 19 over until Friday morning. Senator Rieger, I hope you'll...
Chair?
Senator Kelly?
If amendment was necessary, could it be done in the Rules Committee? Isn't Senator Rieger a member of the Rules Committee? No? You don't do it?
The Rules Committee Chairman is responding negatively to that idea. I just assumed to it here.
I'd like to know about it myself.
We'll hold Senate Bill 19 over until Friday. Senator Rieger, hope you can work with Mr. Quinelli. And if we're going to have an amendment, if we could please try to get it to us tomorrow.
Madam Chair, it's not my intent to try to hold this bill up.
I understand.
It's a good bill. I think it's just going to loophole. It should be cleaned up.
We'll move on now to Senate Bill 46. You have in your packet the CS that we adopted on Monday. You also have a new fiscal note from Department of Fish and Game to the CS for Senate Bill 46 Finance. I know that the prime sponsor is in Senator Frank's office. Diana, would you ask Senator Miller if he wishes to testify? In the meantime, we have Darcy Beck, who has asked to testify on Senate Bill 46. Go ahead, please.
My name is Darcy Beck, and I'm representing the Alaskan Environmental Lobby in its opposition to Senate Bill 46. Senate Bill 46 would be detrimental to the wildlife of Alaska, as well as a waste of the taxpayers' money. Concerns over biological issues have been well documented. Moose farming will increase the threat of disease in both domestic and wild populations. There will be negative effects on predator populations as game farmers try to control predation. Senate Bill 46 also creates a financial incentive for the illegal harvest of wild moose. The fiscal notes attached to this legislation show little or no tangible cost to the state. Heavily of concern over the potential costs that could arise. The Department of Environmental Conservation would be responsible for the cost of monitoring, treating disease and livestock. The Department of Fish and Game would be responsible for the cost of responding to complaints from tourists and other interested parties concerned by the treatment of captive moose. The would also be responsible for the cost of controlling disease in wild species transmitted by domestic species. Department of Public Safety would pay the cost of increased enforcement to control pollution. Although many of these costs are not listed in the fiscal notes, they are real costs that would come from the agency's budget. I'd also point out that the magnitude of these costs may not be realized until a tragedy occurs. For example, we cannot forecast what it would cost the state if an outbreak occurs. We can only look for other examples. In Alberta, $10 million was spent, and 2,000 domestic elk were eradicated in an unsuccessful effort to control an outbreak of TB. In conclusion, it is evident that the biological risk and economic cost of this program far outweigh any possible benefits. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beck. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Beck? Senator Sharp.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'd request that the individual present the documented facts on the Alberta case to track it along.
All right, I'll get those to you.
Thank you, Senator Sharp. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much. What's the will of the committee on Senate Bill 46?
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
Have we adopted the committee substitute?
Yes, we did on Monday.
I would move the committee substitute to Senate Bill 46, Finance, out of committee with individual recommendation.
And the finance. Sorry, and the fiscal notes. Okay, there's a motion to move Senate Bill 46. Is anyone opposed to that? Okay, Senate Bill 46 has moved with individual recommendations. The appropriate fiscal notes also. Okay. Senator Sharp, it would be my intent for you to take up both Senate Bill 106 and 126 together, since they do speak to the same topic. We do have in our files proposed CSs for both bills. For CS 106, we have a Kramer draft of 3293, draft R. For Senate Bill 126, we have a Kramer draft K. Senator Sharp, would you like to move both of those drafts so we'll have those versions as working documents?
Madam Chair, I'd move both CSs for SB 106 and SB 126.
You, there is a motion that I hear that to adopt those two now for working.
That's correct. So we'll have the correct Senator Sharp's newest versions before us. I have a motion to adopt the two CSs. Is anyone opposed? Okay, we do have then before us CS for Senate Bill 106R and CS for Senate Bill 126K. Senator Sharp.
Madam Chair, several on the committee has considerably more institutional memory on inner ties than I do, legislative-wise. But I will be brief. Give a synopsis. In the early 80s, the state committed major sums of general funds to construct four hydroelectric projects, two in Southeastern, one in Kodiak, and one in Valdez. So at that time, the legislature, approximately that time, the legislature set aside $200 million in the Special Rail Energy Fund to utilize on energy projects that would provide similar long-term benefits to South Central and Interior Alaska. This legislation proposed, I believe, will carry out this original legislative intent by constructing a power grid connecting the major population centers of Alaska with an electric intertie system. This interconnected system would present long-term benefits to over 70% of the Alaskan population. The major benefits offered by such an intertie system are, one, a reliability of service, two, economy of size, three, a mix of generating sources, including hydroelectric, natural gas, coal, and petroleum fuel generating units. And finally, unified load dispatching by all the utilities up and down the system to use the most economical unit that's spinning at the time. Section 1 requires that a contract between Alaska Energy Authority, AEA, and the public utilities involved in the intertie be in place. The projects can only proceed if the utilities have agreed to pay any project cost overruns and all future operations and maintenance costs. That section was modified in CS from the original to accommodate comments made on the position paper by the administration. Section 2 authorizes the construction of the 138 kW KVA power line, transmission line between Kenai and Anchorage, and this line increases the capability to deliver major blocks of energy from the Bridal Lakes Hydro Project and to the greater Anchorage load center. Section 3 authorizes the construction of 138 KVA line from Healy to Fairbanks. At the present time, the line comes into Healy from the south at 230 KVA, similar to a 10-inch pipeline, and it dumps into a 6-inch pipeline at Healy, and there's a bottleneck there on what can be delivered from Healy on into the Fairbanks load center. This line will allow the maximum utilization of the total transmission capacity line from Anchorage to Healy. This new line would provide the system to economically deliver Golden Valley Electric their share of Bradley Lake power into the interior, as well as allowing GVA to purchase surpluses of energy from Anchorage-based utilities, which would meet their peak demands. Section 4 authorizes an intertie between Swan Lake and Tyee Lake hydro sites. The economies and benefits offered by this facility are better understood and can better be presented by Senator Taylor. I think that we'll be prepared to comment on that. There was some changes in the CS to accommodate comments in the administration's position statement. Section 5 requires Anchorage Kenai and the Healy Fairbanks intertie construction will only proceed if an agreement between AEA and the utilities that state that the utilities will pay all construction costs over the $99,250,000, which states 50% share, and pay all operating and maintenance costs, future cost of the intertie. In effect, a stop loss on cost overruns for state liability. Section 6, that was another item that was in a position statement, Madam Chair. Section 6, the Act takes effect immediately, and then the SB 126 is the accompanying appropriation bill, which basically follows along and states that contracts have to be in place and so on before projects can proceed. That, in a nutshell, Madam Chair, is a synopsis of the sections of the bill of the CS.
Thank you, Senator Sharp. Questions for the Senator? Senator Curtula.
This is a flat Christmas tree. The four-dam pool arrangement and the funding set aside, and I did offer Senate Bill 25 and 26 to initiate these programs, had the opportunity to get a lot of help. Section 2 should never come out of that funding. That funding, the balance of which had to do with the arrangement that occurred when Bill Sheffield sinked out on the hydroelectric project that set aside. These funds balances are the result of agreements that were made at that time, providing the four-dam pool with its arrangements. We got rid of, quote, the blackmail clause. And these funds were to essentially build the Rail Belt Energy program, which was Bradley Lake, Fairbanks, and eventually Fairbanks down, perhaps to Valdez, or at least Fairbanks down to Copper Center and back down the highway in a continuing circular grid. These funds were supposed to go. We provided the postage stamp for the 17 or 18 million a year to the Bush subsidy support as part of that whole program. There's enough documentation to establish what I'm saying. You want to go back to it. Now we're chipping in on the program for Swan Lake to Tyee. And that's not an obligation that these funds ever intended to have. That's just all I'm saying. May be necessary to get a bill passed or something. It's not correct. It's not where the money should go. If you're going to put it there, some of those funds then ought to go back out to Bush, Alaska, because they have just as much right in as any other area to receive some of these appropriations if we're going to start cutting into what we have left in that balance that was supposed to again be from Bradley to Fairbanks and back down around the highway for a circular grid. Disturbs me to see us cut into these funding sources for yet something as necessary as it may mean be here, but it should stand alone as a separate appropriation from the general fund, not part of this.
Senator Kelly.
I recall discussion from Bradley to Fairbanks. I don't recall discussion back around the highway. that's kind of a recent phenomena.
Well, that was more of an aspiration hope, Senator. We did acquire right away from in the area chairperson. We did acquire right away that we hadn't had from Glen Allen, you know, that general area of Glen Allen down to about Sheep Mountain. As I wrote that particular piece of legislation, and that was all part of this eventual enterprise. So that we tied up the land so that we didn't lose the opportunity of doing that other, whenever it became economically feasible. Anyway, I hate to see that $9 million come out of this fund for something we've already paid for several times before the dam pool concept. And it was part of an agreement at the time. And we even backed away from support programs.
Lieutenant Kelly.
The $9 million, it's not coming out of the Railroad Intertie Reserve, but rather it's coming out of the Power Development Revolving Fund. That's the way I read the bill. Is that correct?
Senator Sharp?
That's correct.
Okay. We do have a number of legislators in the audience and then a number of people signed up to testify. Representative Olberg, you came in first, and why don't I go ahead and take you first, then Senator Lincoln, and then Senator Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Harley Olberg, representing District 35, which is portions of the Eastern Interior, and I'm here this morning to ask you to consider the possibility of strengthening the rail barrel energy system by building an intertie from Sutton to Glen Allen. The means by which that would strengthen the rail barrel energy system is that, in fact, the Copper Valley Electric Association, located in Glen Allen, would become a major purchaser of electricity from the rail belt producers, something on the order initially of about $1 million a year, and as growth in the Copper Valley, Valdez, Glen Allen area were to continue, that figure could rise to as much as $2 million a year of purchases of electricity, which is now excess. There are 3,000 customers in the Copper Valley system. They pay the highest unsubsidized rates in the state. There are other problems with the system in that it goes across some tremendously difficult country, including Thompson Pass. The overall strengthening, I think, would be important to both areas. Economic development is essentially stymied in the Eastern Interior Valdez area at this time because of power costs. We could envision, in fact, at some point in the future, extensions beyond this intertie, but at the present time, I see this request as a strengthening of the rail belt system. I applaud your efforts to improve the rail belt system. I think it's critical to development throughout the state to have a strong centralized power grid from which extensions can be made to any area where there's development potential. Again, I'd like to thank you for this opportunity and respectfully request that you consider adding this intertie to your package. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olberg. What are the numbers on this one?
The number most commonly used, and this is not precise, is $42 million for the total cost, and we would request half of that as the other projects are. I might add that in funding this intertie, the cost of power on about 20 million kilowatt hours per year to Copper Valley would be reduced by two-thirds. They presently pay about 15 cents to generate a kilowatt hour of electricity by diesel. The rail belt producers have offered power in Sutton at about 4 to 5 cents a kilowatt hour. That will save approximately $2 to $3 million a year, a portion of which can be used for debt service and a portion of which can be used for rate mitigation.
Questions for Mr. Olberg? Senator Curtula?
I'm supportive of the concept. I think it's necessary. But, what are your obligations in the Copper Center area for the intertie from Valdez to Copper Center area? They're pretty substantial. And we put that connection to the little fiber project in Valdez. I think the REA is, you know, right tied up in that.
I can't address the overall obligation in terms of dollars. I do know that, of course, there is a four dam pool obligation out of Solomon Gulch, and Solomon Gulch is producing at 100% of capacity. I do not know what the balance of Copper Valley Electric currently looks like.
It looks like somebody's going to eat that intertie. And Valdez to Copper Valley, if we put the other intertie in, and that's $40, $50 million without it, maybe more. Now, not that the intertie is particularly effective, right? It comes and goes with the weather. But it looks like there is a $40, $50 million question there, because that intertie, because it was the only source available at the time.
I suspect if it weren't for the existing intertie between Glen Allen and Valdez, that in fact the Solomon Gulch wouldn't be able to get anywhere near 100% because it would be supplying only Valdez. Another item I should have mentioned is that Otna Corporation has indicated to me that they are willing to consider no-cost right-of-ways within Otna Corporation lands for any extension. They are very supportive of this project.
Senator Kelly.
Well, they're willing to consider it, but if they don't, will part of this money go to Otna to buy land for a right-of-way?
No, sir. Not to my knowledge. I don't want to commit Otna to anything here because I've only had a single conversation with Wilson Justin about, and now we're talking about expansions, not of existing service into Otna-owned property.
Not this particular project.
Right.
Mr. Representative Ogre, could you ask Mr. Justin if he'd provide the committee with a letter stating Otna's interest or?
I'd be glad to.
Other questions for the representative? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Senator Lincoln.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And the rest of the committee members, I'll make this rather brief. I think that my colleague testified very well on the necessity to consider the intertie between Sutton and Glen Allen. Currently, and to maybe reiterate some of what he has already said and to add a little bit more, that currently the Copper Basin and Valdez regions have the highest unsubsidized electric rates in the state, averaging 20 cents per kilowatt. The economic development in this region is directly tied to the electrical rates. An intertie between this region and the rail belt would reduce power costs while opening this region for economic development. Currently, the Copper Basin is connected to the state-owned Solomon Gulch hydroelectric project by a 138-kilowatt transmission line. The Sutton to Glen Allen intertie would bring a tremendous area of Alaska into the rail belt electric system and help develop into the next century. Among the projects whose future in this combined region is directly tied to cheaper electrical rates, the PetroStar refinery in Valdez, the economic development of the Copper River area, the opening and development of the Wrangell-St. Elias National Park. The intertie would reduce the Copper Valley Electric Association's consumption of the diesel fuel and would certainly reduce the exhaust emissions problems due to the due to mothballing the expensive two diesel generators presently used in the winter in Glen Allen. The present population of this combined region that will be affected are 8,000 residents. And Madam Chair, if I might just indulge the committee for a moment to read just a portion of communication that I've received from the area in support of such an intertie. This came from the Copper River Native Association, Ken Johns, Executive Director, who states, I have met with members of the board and staff of CVEA to discuss alternatives to these high rates. Most alternatives seem to be Band-Aid type remedies with no long-term solution. The one option that almost guarantees a long-term solution to our high electric rates is the proposed intertie from Sutton to Glen Allen. This intertie would connect CVEA to a rail belt grid, would provide reduced cost power to the CVEA service territory, and it would eliminate the CVEA's need to operate the high-cost diesel generation plants. The other portion that I'd like to just read in for the record is from the Copper Valley Electric Association. It's a feasibility report on the Sutton-Glen Allen line, and a portion of it reads that the CVA's member owners pay some of the highest unsubsidized retail rates in the United States. The major part of the rate differential between CVA and the Railbelt utilities is attributed to the cost of power generation. It has been recognized for a number of years that the interconnection of CVA system to the Railbelt transmission grid is the only certain way to open the door to a long-term power supply and to the opportunity to initiate a significant and meaningful rate reduction program. If you don't already have this, I would be happy to give you a copy of this. It's quite a lengthy feasibility report that was done, and I could supply the committee members with that. Furthermore, Madam Chair, I would like to point out for the committee is my concern, in addition to not having the Glen Allen Sutton intertie as part of the bill, is my concern that with all of the interties put in here, as I believe Senator Curtula said, this sounds like a Christmas tree bill, but the only part of the Christmas tree that is missing is the rural portion of the PCE. And I'm very fearful that if, in fact, all of these pieces get added to the bill, and it is a very tightly tight title, that it would be impossible to put in PCE at a later point. As you all are aware, Senate Bill 124, which is the governor's bill relating to this whole inner tie, including PCE, is not a part of this discussion today. And I'm fearful if this goes forward that we in Bush, Alaska, would not have the opportunity to talk or to even discuss what the needs are out there. Just Saturday, or Monday rather, in the Anchorage Times, there was an article in there, a rather lengthy article, about the Lime Village situation, where it's a community of approximately 30 people who have no electricity. And in the article says that an informal survey done in 1991 found 15 year-round settlements without electrical systems. Canyon Village, Chicken, Dolina, Edna Bay, Flat, Healy Lake, Living Word, McCarthy, Myers, Chuck, Point Baker, Port Protection, Slana, Quail Pass, and I don't know if that is the complete list, but we have to be concerned as the leaders of the state for looking at the whole picture of the state for electrification and as cheap a power as possible. And I feel that we're not doing that. We're not looking at a whole picture, and I certainly would have liked to have had, and I don't know if somewhere in the process, if the Alaska Energy Authority had an opportunity to participate in the discussions of these two bills or the overall plan. Surely the state must have some kind of plan, or we should have some kind of plan for energy throughout the state, and not just a hit and miss. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify before the committee.
Thank you, Senator Lincoln. Certainly the AEA is here today to testify. While the governor has introduced a complete restructuring plan of the Energy Authority, and a portion of that deals with the continuation of power cost equalization, from looking at that plan, the additional dollars needed for capitalization of the plan, primarily for the power cost equalization, are just not on the table that I see, but I don't know whether we're going to have that bill before us. We do have these before us now, and it's somewhere in the system. Senator Kelly and then Senator Curtula.
Well, I just wanted to ask the senator, I know that she's asked us to put a portion of the project in. Is it her intent to support the bill on the floor if, in fact, we insert that portion of the project?
Thank you for your question, Senator. As I have stated, that I'm concerned about an overall energy plan for the state. And until I can see that we have an energy plan for the whole state and that the Bush Alaska is not being left out of the loop, that somewhere we have some assurance that the PCE is going to be considered and is a part of the overall plan, that's what I want to look at very carefully.
Madam Chair, we have been spending a great deal of money every year on PCE with the understanding that this money remained in the rail belt. It has nothing to do with PCE. I consider them totally separate issues, but if the senator who's asking us to put a portion of the railroad energy money into her district isn't going to vote for the bill on the floor, then I'm not going to support putting that amendment into this bill.
Thank you, Senator Kelly. Senator Couture.
Well, there's two questions. One is, and I don't have a position at the moment on this, but I think that the committee needs to know if we make the connection from Glen Allen to Sutton, I've been supportive of, and am. What happens to the existing line from Valdez to Glen Allen? Who's responsible for it? Putting that line in, say, at $40 million may also make us eat another $40 or $45 million worth of line we've already built in, because there's nobody to pay for that line at that moment. Power is generated in Valdez, ends up at Copper Center on a good year. And there's no purchase in Copper Center. There's no use of that line. Valdez can't eat it. I suspect they would probably have a legal case about that moment with the decision being made here. So I'd like to know, if we build that line, part of that question is, who is responsible for the existing line that supplies power? And where does that come in and fit into the whole program of building in? And I think we need to know that answer. I may well be a supporter of it no matter what, but I'd like to know where it fits. And I think it's the one we don't want to stumble into for $45 or $50 million next year. Again, if the existing Copper Center people have to pay for that line no matter what, then providing them power from an alternate source, you see, is not going to cheapen their power one bit, if they're still going to have that as part of their overhead. So that's a more complicated question than initially at first blush might seem, particularly if we have a shortage of funds for these purposes. On the question of Section 2, if they take all of the funding, I think then that precludes some reconstruction that we've been doing for years in the Bush programs, where the lines go down and we just take the money and authorize it from that fund, I think. That's that revolving fund that goes in and rebuilds and brings up to snuff, at least partially so, all kinds of these rural lines that float around between villages and between the powerhouse and the village and so on. We run into that every year. If you eat that up for this one program, unless I'm looking at the wrong fund, there is no money left for rural Alaska to rebuild and reconstruct. And that's where that money has been coming from for 10 years or so, 6, 8 anyway. So I'd be very careful about that funding source. Now, I may be still wrong on the first glance of where that power source is. That would worry me if I was a real legislator.
Any other questions for Senator Lincoln? Okay, thank you, Senator. You're welcome to stay with us at the table if you'd like. Senator Taylor. And by the way, we do have Mr. Garzini from the Energy Authority, and we hope he can answer the. He's saying he can. So we'll get to your question, Senator Taylor.
Thank you very
Senator
much. Senator Taylor. Is the committee considering the original bill, or are we now looking at the committee substitute?
We have Senator Sharp CS's before us.
Yeah. I just became aware of the CS a few moments before the committee met on this subject, and have had little time to consult with my people concerning the very significant changes that are incorporated in that. First, let me start off to respond to the comments made by my good colleague as concerns utilization of the Rail Belt Energy Funds, number one, and then number two, the utilization of the income stream off the four-dam pool. For the last 8 years, I have fought to maintain a commitment made by my former colleague out of Petersburg, as regards agreements on the Rail Belt Energy Fund, and to the best extent possible, we have fought to maintain and preserve the integrity of that agreement. I have always believed that those funds were totally up to the discretion of the people who are elected from that area, and that other people within the state should not be tapping into them. And I've been in various battles and shoulder to shoulder with almost every member of this committee at various times when different folks showed up attempting to raid that fund for one reason or another. My only request throughout was that when the time came for the final distribution of those funds, that those people of Alaska who are currently paying a minimum of 5.5 cents a kW every time we turn our light bulbs on, for the privilege of having received projects that were overbuilt and very poorly engineered by an Alaska Energy Authority group over whom we had no control, that we might be able to use at least a portion of the monies that we're paying every day to pay for our own inner ties so that we can build and develop our electrical structure just as you are building and developing yours. It seemed fair. Up until about a half an hour before this committee started, I had no resistance to that request. My only purpose is that people like my colleague who just testified, who now represents the Solomon Gulch area, that those people have intertie needs, and they should be considered as part of the overall plan. But should they come out of the Rail Belt Energy Fund? No, I don't believe they should. Any more than should the project that I'm talking about, the Swan Lake Tai project, come out of your Rail Belt Energy Funds. I think we should be asked to pay for those ourselves, out of the monies we're currently paying. Those monies should not be going into the general fund to be just twiddled away wherever they may wish to go. They should not be going to support the Alaska Energy Authority, which can then involve itself in all sorts of other activities, which they are, by the way. At the very least, revolving loan funds should be available to us to come back as revenue to pay off bonds that would finance this construction. It's my understanding that the administration has decided that each of your projects should have to pay 50%, and that you've agreed that that's a fair leveraging of the funds. I have no problem with that. When does my 50% begin? Do I turn on the lights every day at home? Or am I supposed to, I think it was Commissioner Hughes wrote in his position statement, which I also got just this morning, but it was apparently written on the 24th. On the back page it says it would mean, let's see, AEA would oppose the idea of financing 100% of the Tai Swan construction cost. I don't blame them. If I was AEA, I probably would too, but you see, it isn't AEA's money. Comes out of my back pocket, my wife's every month, and we pay our utility bill. But he says he would be opposed to financing 100% of the Tai Swan construction cost from the existing power sales revenue stream, because it would mean no contribution from the affected communities towards the payment of intertai construction costs beyond what they are already paying on existing debt. I guess that means that when I turn on my lights in the future, if I want to have an intertie connecting up Ketchikan, utilizing, for Ketchikan's purposes, some more of the excess power left over in Tai Lake that's currently being spilled, I guess if I want that to occur and want Ketchikan not to burn diesel, then I should be paying another 5 cents on top of what I'm paying right now. That would jack my rates to probably 16 cents. You're paying about 6 cents. In the Anchorage Bowl area, I pay 5.5 cents surcharge before I pay the cost of distribution and the rest of it. Out of that money, by the way, we were told when we signed the power sales agreement with this Alaska Energy Authority that they would be responsible for maintaining these power lines and these dams that they own. The power line between Tai and Wrangell-Petersburg is in terrible shape. Has been almost from the day it was built because it was improperly, in my opinion, designed. Over-designed. We have two of the longest stretches in the North American continent. know why the engineers thought they had to build that Eiffel Tower, I don't know, but we inherited it. Do you realize that AEA is now looking at us and saying, well, you people should be paying the cost of maintaining it? And we're saying, hey, wait a minute, what about the $9.2 million that we're dumping into the general fund every year? Don't we get that back? Don't you come down here and repair your lines out of that? No. It's apparently in a revolving loan fund to be loaned to people. All I want is the money I'm paying every day to come back home and let those people in Kodiak, those people in Solomon Gulch, those people in Ketchikan and Wrangell Petersburg, let them make the decision about what power lines they want. The feasibility study on the intertie between Swan Lake and Tyee was done by Alaska Energy Authority and found to be a very feasible project. In fact, we believe, I just talked to the people on the phone a few minutes ago, that just the increased revenue generated by power sales caused by the use now of Tyee power that's being spilled will pay for 80% of this line. That's the money that we, as consumers, will be paying to build this line. We're happy to do that. Under the worst case scenario, the state would have to put in $20 million out of the $55 million to build this line. Their worst case scenario includes having the pulp mill go down in Ketchikan. We don't think it's going to get that bad. All I want out of this legislation is the authority to use four damn pool monies to pay off revenue stream to pay off the interest. Let us pay for it ourselves. We're not asking for general fund dollars. Let us pay for our own project. And then let Kodiak in the future pay for theirs. Let Solomon Gulch in the future pay for theirs. Because that continuing income stream can be utilized to bring power to the remote villages. In passing, I wanted to make one other comment. Of the 15 villages that my predecessor mentioned that were remote villages out in the bush, Edna Bay, Myers Chuck, Point Baker, Port Protection, and Whale Pass are all within about 50 miles of my house. Every one of them has the potential, once this new one is built down to Ketchikan, of being closer to a grid. I would like to get them on it, too. I'd like to get the grid down there to do it.
Senator Tua.
Position of being a skunk at the lawn party. You have to go back to the whole Susitna effort in which the four damn pool concept was a little spin-off. I don't know how much money we subsidized, but we found out into these hybrid projects, the state funds, at either no interest to the state or at direct subsidy. Showing about vast amounts of subsidy, cash contributions on a continuing basis. I remember Kodiak getting $8 million not that long ago, just cash right up front, for this construction, and I know they all did. The Bush tied in as what, the postage stamp addition for PCE. These funds were supposed to come back to the general fund, or we were supposed to get the city. And you can't help that. In our wisdom, our ignorance, we put $4.1 billion extra in the permanent fund, and that would build the Susitna project, and the power for everybody would be cheaper, and most of us here would get more than $1,000 a year apiece back in electricity. And we may even want to change this. He makes a very good case. But the history of it is that, you know, we're still, there was an overall concept, the heart of which was destroyed by Bill Sheffield. I mean, he's the responsible guy. The buck stops there. And now we're spinning off with less than, good projects. In other words, the system was supposed to carry the bush, an extra cent kilowatt or something there. Now it doesn't. The general fund does. And you know, so none of that concept really holds anymore. But maybe we ought to look at it and make a very good case for the project. But the historic background is that, you know, it's all supposed to come back to general fund, pay it back over a long period of time for the money that we put in as starting money. And how we've used it since has been pretty much a political decision. And if it's a political decision to put the $9 million or whatever it is into Tyee rather than to repair bush lines, and little short lines under a revolving concept with the local REA, the Greater Anchorage Fairbanks area, so be it. It really doesn't tie in historically to what our original program was to be. This part of it sort of does, the part of using the balance of those funds that were available was an amendment to the history in which that was to go into a grid, wherever. But that was supposed to be a grid that had intentionally originated at Douglas Canyon, but now really originates at Bradley Lake and going with that part. If there's any more obligation, governments have no memory, but if it wasn't that part, still, you can see a full line there. The rest of it is, I think, who's got confused together but still.
If I might.
Senator Taylor.
Just in response very briefly, I certainly agree with a lot of those comments. I don't find them at all offensive. I think they're accurate. I just feel that the eventual gridding of this state is better done and controlled by the people who are paying for it than probably any state agency. We ended up with facilities in Southeast and Kodiak and other places that I think cost overruns were very high. We didn't ask for those cost overruns. And we kind of got stuck with it. And that's history. Don't mind that. I just want to assure this committee that if there's going to be a way to connect up Ketchikan and keep them off a piece of power, because they're running out of power, within 5 years they're belly up and they're in brownouts in 5 years. It has to be out of Tahiti, and Ketchikan themselves came up with $350,000 to jumpstart this intertides and do all the environmental impact statements and analysis on it, for most of them. So they started that process and gave us the money, gave AEA the money to do it. They don't want to go ahead with that. If Juneau's ever going to put mines in this town, unless you want to have big diesel generators out here powering those mines, they've got to get to some inexpensive hydropower. The only way to do it, Snitisham, Tai, they call the intertie. That one you'll find even appearing in some recent AEA documents. How are we going to build it? Well, I don't want to have to come back and ask you for it out of the general fund. I'd sure like to be in a position where I can say we can now take, because we've spent 5-6 years paying off the Ketchikan Tai one, now we got this next one, and let the AEA board, working through the Power Control Committee, whatever they call it, PCE, out of the four damn pool, let them sit down and say, yeah, the one to Juneau is probably the next one we ought to build, and maybe Sutton is the one after that, or vice versa. Maybe Sutton is the next one to go, and then we come down and look at Juneau. And maybe then we take a look outside the grid and say, yeah, we got to get an interloop going all the way up through Canada and loop all of Southeast Alaska in with the Canadian grid so as to cause some real cost savings. Those things ought to be available out in the future, and if we don't do something now to set up a mechanism by which it can happen, every one of these projects will have to come in and be begging monies out of a general fund that isn't going to have them, I'm afraid, in the future. This way they can pay for themselves as they go along. That's all I'm asking for, the authority to do it in that fashion. And whether it's the full $9 million, or whether it's the 7.7, I think it is, that actually goes into the revolving loan fund, I don't have that great a concern. That's a political choice, a policy call for this committee to decide that yes, we should probably still be giving $1.5 million or $2 million to AEA to pay for their administration. So I kind of think we all have a share in that cost. 7.7, 5, 9, I'm open. I just want to be able to pay for these things over time by ourselves.
Thank you, Senator Taylor. Are there other questions for the Senator?
I'd like to hear too much.
You're welcome to join us at the table also. We'll go down to Ron Garzini with the Energy Authority.
For the record, I'm Ron Garzini, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. I'm going to be really brief, and I know you're all grateful to hear that. First, let me say that I'm eager to work with Senator Sharp on this bill. We believe that with amendments, this can be a major step for economic development. I think that there's general and strong support for the idea of interties. Furthermore, I'm interested in working with Senator Taylor to see if we can accommodate. You may recall that the original Energy Authority plan did propose a Southeast intertie. In fact, interestingly enough, it had more favorable terms than those currently in the CS. So we obviously are supportive of that. And I guess my suggestion is we have 9 amendments that we view as appropriate for Senate Bill 106. And I did indicate to Senator Sharp that that we think that they're consistent with the wishes of the legislature, and they're things that we certainly think you should consider. We would like to see perhaps a hearing on energy issues, including the interties and other statewide energy issues. At that point in time, we think we could probably have worked out with Senator Sharp some of the appropriate amendments. Our position on the intertie subjects all along has been that we support the interties, and we would like to see some form of a statewide energy plan that incorporates interties and other issues. And I think that if the Senate would hold a hearing, allow us to invite urban and rural people, I think that we can coalesce a plan around Senator Sharp's bill that will work. We think that there's some additional authorities to properly serve the utilities that we need. There are some things going on outside of this bill and outside of PCE that we think are very favorable that the legislature needs to know about. For example, we believe that the Eklutna and Snedisham acquisitions will be in the president's energy package. And so we want to make darn sure that we have the ability to go ahead and conclude those arrangements that have long been supported by the state. And the recent data I get is that is going to be successful. So we need to make sure that if the president's economic package does allow the utilities to acquire Eklutna and Snedisham, we want to be able to go forward, because those are great things, I think, for Alaska. So those are the kinds of issues that we'd like to bring into the discussion. Make sure in our opinion, the greatest single thing you could do for the economic development of the state is probably set an energy course like this bill starts. Lastly, I'd like to just answer a couple of the questions that have been raised. One is the question of the Glen Ellen to Valdez line. Our proposal is that we conclude the feasibility issues of the Sutton to Glen Ellen line. We have asked that funds be reserved to allow that to go forward. It's our opinion that the construction cost of intertying Sutton to Glen Ellen is approximately $40 to $60 million. We don't exactly know the dollar amount. I think during your discussion you talked about rights of way and some of these other issues which would impact economics. So what we'd like to see is an authorization to proceed on that project, either subject to certain constraints. We do think that the economics can be worked out under some reasonable term, but we don't yet know the economics of it. Once we get to Glen Ellen, we anticipate serving the needs of Valdez on a far more economic basis by combining Solomon Gulch Hydro and low-cost gas and power from the rail grid, so that Valdez can actually perhaps even be selling power to the grid during the summer months when Solomon's got a lot of water. In the winter months, they'll be able to shop for low-cost electricity. In the case of Southeast Alaska, we do believe that the standard is the tie to Swan. It appears to us that there is a strong, marketable, on an interruptible basis, source of power for Tai, and it appears to us that the logical location to ship that to is Swan. We have done virtually all of the studies that are needed to be done, and given a purchase agreement from Ketchikan or something of that nature, we have no objection to that project. We do think that is the project in Southeast Alaska most likely to succeed. And that's why I say we're interested in working with Senator Sharp and Senator Taylor to try and find a way to accommodate that project. I repeat, and I don't know if Senator Taylor heard me, but the economics of our proposal that we made at the beginning of the session is actually more favorable, we think, than the one that's on the table now. So in the next week, we'd like to work on that. See, it's our goal to set up a standard that makes that project work. The Tai line, some issues with regard to the obligations of the Energy Authority with the Four Dam Pool were raised, and I just want to comment on those. First of all, I think Senator Taylor is correct when he says that the Tai line was not well built. I think that there were some mistakes in the development of the Tai line. Second of all, I think he also said that we have an obligation, the Energy Authority, to fix that line, and I agree that we do. It's our intention from existing funds. Last I looked, a significant amount of dollars within the Four Dam Pool major maintenance accounts that is available to us to attack those problems. And what I'd like you to do is just be aware that number one, I agree that there was design errors. Number two, that we have an obligation to fix the problem. And number three, I think we have the money within the Four Dam Pool accounts for major repair and maintenance that can address that issue. If we don't, then I think when we've consumed the several million dollars we do have, then we might have to deal with it in some other fashion. But it's not an obligation that the Four Dam Pool communities in terms of the power development revolving loan fund or any of that. With that, I think I will conclude. Obviously, I'd like a hearing and a chance to talk about a lot of other issues. We feel that a statewide energy plan should be looked at. People have indicated concerns with certain issues, such as, quote unquote, creating an energy authority that's more like a railroad. I agree that the votes are not there to do that kind of thing. I have not proposed that. The key components that we're concerned about are the four interties, plus some sort of a solution for rural Alaska. And if those five items are taken care of, I will do my best to generate strong support for it.
Thank you, Mr. Garzini. Did you touch upon Senator Kutula's question about the who is responsible for paying for the present Valdez to Glen Allen line? Should the Sutton Glen Allen intertie?
Present Valdez to Glen Allen intertie is it's an essential piece of the Copper Valley system. For example, we're talking about going from Sutton to Glen Ellen. So that Cook Inlet Gas, Bradley Power, Healy Power can be brought into the grid in Copper Valley. And that would be primarily a wintertime, fall, spring flow. In the summertime, we expect the possibility of Solomon Power flowing through the Valdez to Glen Ellen and on to Sutton for sale into the grid. So that line is essential.
3 months can it pay for the overhead for the rest of the year?
Well, those are, Senator Kutula, those are the kinds of issues that we right now have a contract with Copper Valley to look at all of those economic issues, and that's why what we're saying is set aside some money, set some criteria for statutorily proceeding. You may not know, but right now there's also an issue having to do with a coal plant and being constructed in Glen Ellen, and we are also looking at that. So we're looking at the options of providing affordable power in the Valdez area. and we expect to have the cost of construction, all of the statutory required steps completed in the next few months. And that's why we say, if you set some standards